the preliminary homage. And then we also do Namo Tassa as well. So, if everyone's ready, we'll start with this. You can just say it together. It's not going to be repeat after me, so you can either say it in English or in Pali, and you can slowly learn how to say it, or just read it along in your head. Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadim Svākhāto Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namāmi Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa Okay, it's a little bit of Pali exercise. I tried to get a monk. There's a monk from, another monk from Canada, I think he's, or maybe America, who does some pronunciations, teaches pronunciation. I tried to get him to hold an online pronunciation course, but I don't know, he wasn't interested. Maybe it's not even proper for a monk to do such a course, I don't know. Okay, so now we scroll down to the place where it says, we are here. And we begin our we continue our study. So for those of you who, I don't think there's anybody new here, but if you are new, please don't hesitate to ask questions. That always makes it more interesting. If people have questions now, you're welcome to go ahead and ask them. For those of you who have been diligently studying this text throughout the week, getting ready for the weekly chance to delve into the Dhamma. So I'll just start talking. You're welcome to ask questions. Interrupt me as you like. Where we left off, what we covered last week was the opening summary. So as I said, this is kind of like a debate technique. It's a formal method of argumentation. That actually we're pretty used to. You state your argument, and then you start to back it up. So in the beginning, he kind of does that. You know, that's sort of how he's approaching this. He's making statements, actually giving it away in the beginning, saying it's all non-self. But now he's going to start from this point on. He's going to start to bring them to the level that they can understand that as well. So here, again, we try to think of this as a practical exercise for ourselves. So we should all be getting into the mode, beginning to remind ourselves of what is real. What is real about our experience, what is real about, or what is real in the universe, which is our moment-to-moment experience. So this is using mindfulness, we bring ourselves back to look at the experience as it is. And this would have been what the five monks would have been doing for the past 5 days. Remember, it's been 5 days since the first sutta. Sorry, I have to invite someone here. The first sutta was given on Asalaha Puja, Asalaha Purnami, the full moon of the month of Asalaha. And this is 5 days later. So in the past 5 days, the monks have been doing diligent meditation day and night. They wouldn't have been sleeping. I would say it doesn't say in the text, but it would be fair to say that for the past 5 days, they have been doing around-the-clock meditation, which probably meant no sleep. I would doubt if they did any sleep during that time. Because these were hardcores. These guys had been torturing themselves for 6 years. It wasn't that big of a deal for them to start to do meditation. It was probably a lot more fun, actually, because finally they could eat and they could enjoy the pleasant experiences, or they didn't have to forego pleasant experiences. So when pleasant experiences came up, they began to allow themselves to experience it. And we have to be clear, allowing themselves to experience it didn't mean particularly enjoying it in the sense of liking it or attaching to it or appreciating it, but they had to experience it with the same clarity of mind as unpleasant experience. So for the past 5 days they had been doing this. And if you just do it for a few moments here, you can kind of get a feeling of what effect that it would have on the mind. Because people will read this and find it very difficult to understand, how do they know these things? How could they give these answers just right off the top of their head? And the point is that here they are in a meditation course. When we read it, we think of it as theory. So we think in our minds, well, logically, are these things impermanent? But that's not what he's asking here. He's using the word conceive, which is kind of mental, no? But what he really means is based on the past 5 days practice, what do you think? Because manyata just really means you think. King means what? What do you think in that regard? Or what do you think of that? In regards to what I've just said, what do you think? Based on your practice, obviously. And then he says, Rupang nichang va anichang vati. Is form permanent or impermanent? And so, rather than thinking of this as an intellectual exercise where you have to think of form as you remember it, we should look at form as we practice it. And I guess at first glance it might be difficult. At first glance it might seem that it's actually quite permanent. So you're sitting on the chair, right? And what is the form? Well, form, one example is the feeling of your bottom against the chair. And that feeling seems permanent, right? Because it's a concept in our mind. The concept is permanent. The concept of us sitting on the chair and the concept of this feeling. But if you examine the feeling, not exactly examine, but experience, I guess, is the best word, or the word we use is mindfulness. If you're mindful of the experience, means you're really with it and really aware of it and continuously aware of every moment, every present moment experience, you'll see that actually the feeling of the chair on the chair is actually something that arises and ceases. It comes when you're aware of it and it disappears when the mind goes elsewhere. Our mind isn't quick enough normally to see this. In the practice of meditation, we can see the easiest way, of course, to see is to pick something that arises, pick something that has a definite arising and ceasing, and that's why the stomach is really a good object. The stomach is an incredible object, actually, and it is really worth reiterating this again and again about how the stomach works to allow you to see impermanent suffering and non-self, because people don't like to watch this sort of object. They don't like to watch something that's unpleasant in this way. And they don't like to watch in this way. They would rather find some way that is going to make them feel peaceful and calm. But when you watch the stomach and say to yourself, rising, you'll see the movement begin and end. And then falling will begin and end. And this sets the tone for the rest of your investigation. It sets your mind in the right manner, in the right frame, so that then you note everything that arises and ceases. When a pain arises, you notice it arising. When it ceases, you notice it ceasing. So this is actually an easy question for someone who's undergoing a meditation course. It's easier if you explain a little bit about what is meant by this. So when we talk about form, well, for ordinary people that means the body, right? And so you'd have to think about it and you'd have to say, well, yeah, actually the body is impermanent because I was born and before that the body didn't exist. And then I'm going to die, and when I die then the body will stop existing and so on. So form is impermanent. Of course, then you might come to the other conclusion, the whole, what is this, the principle of, I don't forget what it's called, scientists, people who are science majors can tell us, that matter is, energy is neither created nor destroyed. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. Principle of something or something. Thermal something or other. Principle of conservation, that's it. Conservation of energy. So then you might say, well, then it's permanent, right? In one sense, it's permanent. Thermodynamics, that's it, thank you. This is high school coming back to me. I've been out of science for a long time. So by thinking about it, you can come to any conclusion, of course. You can twist and turn in different ways. In general, even by thinking about it, you'll come to see that it's not permanent. And if you do quite a bit of thinking about it, which I'm not suggesting you do, but it does kind of show something. Things like the eternal, someone asked a question today about why it's not possible for Christian, I think you said Christian, I don't remember, but the idea of a theistic eternal heaven. Why is that not possible? And I think even just by thinking about it, it has a lot of, you know, it's really a part of the experience, no? Because here we are talking about, as someone mentioned, nothing's impermanent. Here we are talking about impermanence, and wham, it hits you like a ton of bricks. Brings it right home. So it would be, if we were to get upset at this and say, oh, and get fed up and say, oh, this is useless. Why isn't it constant? No? We wouldn't really be taking the lesson to heart. We might as well leave anyway, because we're not getting anything out of the teaching. So we have to look at our responses to this. How does it affect our minds? When am I getting worried? Uh-oh, my audience has to wait for me. And this, how is the audience doing? What's going on in your mind when all this goes on? Oh, this is crazy. Why don't we just go off into the forest and practice meditation? Okay, so let's recap. Where are we? I don't know where you lost me. What was I talking about before the sound went? Does anyone have a sense of where we left off? Heaven. Talking about eternal heaven, no? But eternal heaven implies the implication is that something that arises will never cease. But really, one of the greatest ways to refute that is to ask the question, well, if you went to heaven, and if this deity of yours, or whatever, this law, sent you to heaven, what's to stop you from leaving it in the future? And by future, it's quite open, because eternity is not just a long time. In fact, eternity is actually illogical. You can't say, oh, eternity is a very long time. You always hear theists say this. It's this funny thing to say, you know, I really want to help you or so on, and you know, because eternity is a really long time. But eternity is not a long time. Eternity has no end. The word long can't even apply to it. It's a singularity, I believe, is the term. And by that it just means it's impossible. You can't count eternity. I mean, these kind of thought experiments and logical arguments can be helpful. But the point is that this isn't what we're talking about here. The point is that we're talking about our ordinary experience that actually we do take to be permanent. Because we only experience reality, as they say, tangentially. Just for a brief instant do we experience reality, and then we're off in illusion again. So when we see something, we see it, but immediately we're thinking about what we see and conceiving about it. So the Buddha had this, the first sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. He talks about how someone conceives in regards to rupa, in regards to form, in regards to just everything. We conceive and we find ourselves in it, and we come up with ideas about it. And he said an enlightened being doesn't conceive in regard to these things. They experience and fully understand it to the end of it, to the core of it. That's what we're really trying to do here, is experience the very essence of experience. In the same way that they know infinity is big, you know that eternity is long. I disagree. Infinity isn't big either. The word big can't possibly apply to infinity. Infinity is also a singularity. It's unquantifiable. I don't know. I mean, this isn't. We could have an argument, and it's something to think about. But no, it seems to me that it's outside of the realm of what is long. It's impossible to the point that it includes every single possibility. So for someone to say that you can go to heaven for eternity, to me is directly contradicting, is in direct contradiction of the meaning of eternity. Because eternity implies enough time for anything to happen. I don't know. Maybe it's a little too, but I think there's some argument along those lines that the whole idea of eternity, staying in some state for eternity, is illogical. Is actually a direct contradiction. I think there's an argument for that. But I think there's certainly an argument for not being able to quantify infinity or eternity. Or even call them big or long. I think that's my point, is that it's an illusion. The idea that you could just points to the fact that we don't understand these things. Eternity can never begin. It can have no beginning. It's illogical to think that eternity has a beginning. The only way for something to stay somewhere eternally is for it to have always been there, or always been in that state. I think that's the point. You know those jokes that we have? When we were kids, we always had this joke that we would play with each other. It said, what was it? I hate you. I hate you more. I hate you infinity. I hate you infinity plus one. I hate you infinity plus two. And so on. John, that's a good, I mean, that's a good point, and that's certainly what I think that's really what, or a very important part of what we mean by impermanence, is that it's regarding change. But that's not what impermanent means. The meaning of the word anicca, nicca means permanent, or always. Anicca means it's not always there. I guess you could translate it as inconstant or changing or so on. But there are other words that mean changing. I believe he uses one later on, viparinama, either that or in the next sutta. But I mean, either way, it's in regards to our idea that things last. Our idea that there is I believe that's, I guess that's what you're talking about. That's exactly, the important aspect of anicca was the vanishing. That's what you begin to see in the meditation. You see that the things that arise cease. And you see them ceasing constantly. And so you give up this idea of the Atman, of the self. But I just want the where I deviate a little bit, and it may be not a deviation, depending, I'm not sure exactly where you're coming from, but is that it's not really so philosophical. It's visceral. It's how we experience nowadays. Nothing to do with Brahmins, nothing to do with any religious doctrine, but just our deluded state of being and of understanding. So every moment we misconceive, and this is what I was talking about the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. An ordinary, if you read the sutta, it's an ordinary individual conceives in regards to these things. Oh, this is this, this is that. And it just comes naturally to us in our everyday experience to take things as being me and being mine, as being lasting, as being stable. So when we're sitting in this chair, we think we're sitting in this chair. We think the experience of sitting in the chair is constant. Right? That's really what it means. It's not a philosophical and intellectual or religious doctrine. The Buddha is really talking about us sitting in chairs. When we look at the computer screen, we think we're looking at the computer screen constantly. We think the experience of the computer screen is a constant experience. As we think with everything, you think you're listening to me constantly. You think you're hearing my voice, and that's a constant experience. But there's so much going on there. And the essence of it is that, well, in the example of my voice, this is why when I used to give talks, I took it from another teacher, but when he used to give talks, he would always say, okay, time to listen to the Dhamma. Everyone listen at your ear and say to yourself, hearing, hearing, hearing. And he said, and when you hear my voice, you can hear my voice arising and ceasing. This is how you listen to the Dhamma. So I would often do this, and people find it kind of funny. But it really, it's amazing actually when you do that. And you start to hear the voice arising and ceasing. And you start to watch your interpretations, your recognitions of the sounds arising and ceasing. And this whole universe unfolds that was previously inaccessible to us. And you can start to viscerally, you can feel your delusions evaporating. You can feel your misunderstandings falling off. You feel relieved of this, all of the judgments, all of the delusions, all of the knots that your mind was tied into, and suddenly your mind is just experiencing, just here. So, yeah, I think what you're saying is exactly, it's spot on. But just to be clear that we're talking about the important point, he's just asking them about their meditation practice. And so they begin to see this. So they say it's impermanent. Anicchang bante. And then he says, okay, so you've admitted this. I mean, at this point, part of it is you could say that, no, at this point they're pretty convinced. They've been practicing for 5 days and they're all sotapanna at this point, according to the commentaries, which makes sense. So he's not really, it's not really an argument. It's more like, and you can see how he repeats things. Because he actually repeats this in full. It's been abbreviated by the people who put it together, but he would actually go in full here. And so by repeating this again and again, he's bringing them back again and again to their experience and guiding them through it. Just as you could say, I'm in a way guiding you here, and by speaking in this way, it brings you back again to the experience. Yes, as John says, we misperceive the moment to moment, believe there is an entity providing continuity. But in meditation, seeing disappearance, we understand there is no continuity and thus no self. But I would just say that it doesn't have to be a belief in an entity that arises. That's a part of it, but there's three levels. I put this here, actually. If you scroll up to the top, I put it. My first note on this sutta, at the bottom of it, I never actually talked about it. The three kinds of perversions: sanya, citta, and ditti. Sanya vipalasa is the perversion of perception. That's at the very visceral level. So it doesn't have to be a view of anything. It's just the perception, or the seeing something, or conceiving it to be continuous. It's just a perception in that way. Then citta is when you start to think based on that perception, right? So when you hear my voice, and you start recognizing the words and so on, and you get the recognition, this is him speaking, and then you start to think, there is a continuity there, or there is a permanence there. When you think that, that's citta vipalasa. And then when it becomes a view, when it becomes a belief that, oh, this lasts, this continues, then that's ditti vipalasa. So it doesn't have to get to the extent of having a view about it. And in fact, I would believe the of these three, a sotapanna has gotten rid of the third one. So a sotapanna will still think wrong things. They might still think, oh, that's permanent or so on. But they can never give rise, they'll immediately realize, oh, that's a dumb, that thought's not correct. They will never give rise to the view. They will never have a belief that there is a self. And of course, they will conceive things to be belonging to self. They still have conceit. So they can still have this. What the perception means, like when you think of yourself as better than someone, or you think of yourself as worse than someone, or you conceive of something as belonging to self, but don't ever give rise to the view. It's just all of, like, conceit is a good example. But really all I wanted to say is that it begins on the level of the sanya, of the perception. Buddha taught the difference between becoming and being. There's being but not a reified entity. I just mean to say that's a little bit intellectual. The Buddha taught what we're studying now, really, moment to moment experience in regards to the five aggregates. He didn't ever say, as I talked about last week, he didn't ever say, as far as I know, that there is no self. He just pointed out, if you take a view of self, there's no view of self that won't lead to suffering, that won't lead you to clinging and therefore identification and therefore suffering. So he said, so give up all your views of self. But the idea of there being this, there being that, it's certainly not what his focus was. The Buddha taught that there is experience, and he taught us to how to understand experience. Okay, so once they've accepted that these things are not permanent, then he asks this important point. This is actually more important philosophically. Is that, well, what does it mean to say something that is impermanent? Yampana nichang, and he says, but what is impermanent is that. Is that suffering, or is it suffering, or is it happiness? And he uses these words, dukkhang wa sukhang wa. And so he translates them here as painful or pleasant, which I don't think they're bad translations. This is one place where I don't mind his translation, but it's difficult. You know, a translator has a great difficulty in places like this, because you can't really explain what's being said here in any word or the other, I don't think, in any translation or another. You just have to say, are they dukkhang or are they sukhang? And these words work really well, because if you look at the way the words are formed, they're actually directly opposites. Su means well, and du means poorly, or su means good, and du means bad. So basically, are they something that is good or are they something that is bad? That's really a good way of explaining here, if you want to be general and cover everything. Are they good or are they bad? But good and bad in the sense, are they of any benefit or are they of detriment? And I don't, that maybe doesn't even capture it, because really the meaning here, and we should go back to the first sutta for our meaning, the meaning is, are they something that, when clung to, leads to happiness or leads to suffering? Are they something that you could take up and find happiness based on your clinging to them? Something that could bring you happiness if you hold on to it. Because as we said in the first sutta, it's not that these things are painful in themselves, it's that, just like fire, if you grab them, they'll burn you. It's only when we cling to them that they cause us suffering. That's one way, and as I said, there's another way of looking at it, is just they are intrinsically dukkha, means useless or the absence of any purpose or any benefit, absence of any happiness. And his point here is that they are that way because they're impermanent. Because we think things are permanent, we get all sorts of ideas of what is pleasant. So we think certain foods are pleasant, right? We think certain sights, certain sounds are pleasant. And this is our entirely based on our conception of them, our perception of them as being permanent, of them as being an entity. So we listen to a song and we say, yeah, what a great song. And then we have this pleasant feeling based on the song and say, yeah, what a great feeling. And then we get ideas about the song and ideas about everything. You know. When we see something, we get ideas about it. But when you experience, moment-to-moment experience, you don't cling to anything. You don't find anything worth clinging. It's like someone said, I think Stephen was the one who gave me this. Someone recently, I don't remember who it was, talked to me about these dots, the special method of painting. I forget what it's called, point something rather. Where you put some points on a canvas, and if you step back, it looks like a picture. But if you go in close, you realize it's just points. Pointillism, yes, that's it. And this has been used before by Buddhists. Someone wrote a book about it, a book based on the analogy. And it sort of gives a good idea of what we're talking about here. When you go in close, as we do in meditation, you don't find anything. It's not that you go in and you find lots of dukkha. It's not that you have to suffer because you're meditating. It's in fact you realize that you have been suffering. Realize that all of this stuff that you thought was bringing you pleasure is actually so much stress involved. Moment to moment stress. Every moment clinging, grasping, holding, stressing, worrying, fretting, wanting, chasing, needing, clinging. And you don't. It's not intellectual. You just stop, or you never begin. Really, when you see things as they are, it doesn't begin. As the Buddha said that in one sutta, he talks about this thing called papancha. The only reason suffering arises, craving and clinging and suffering arise, is because of making more out of things than they actually are. Our conceiving in things. But if you let go of clinging, you can still experience a different kind of pleasure, or it just doesn't matter. Well, I have to ask in return, do you want a certain kind of pleasure? Is that what your goal is? Because for most of us, that's the way it is. We are looking for pleasure. And if that's sort of where you're getting at, the idea that for most of us, this kind of seems unappealing. It's like, wait a minute. You mean no pleasure? You know, or aren't we trying to gain pleasure? Isn't that what we're looking for? No, everything is as it is. The middle state, you know, people talk about how bland life would be. Believe me, life is not bland for meditators. Life is quite exciting. Exciting, but you're not excited. That's the middle is in one's reactions to reality. Reality stays as it is. Pleasant, painful, highs and lows. But the mind is totally unattached. It's like it becomes a part of the experience. What kind of clinging does cause me to suffer when I hit the wall with my head? Depends why you're hitting the wall with your head. If you're doing it because you think it's a cause for suffering, for happiness, then that's probably delusion. If you're doing it out of anger, then it's out of anger. What kind of clinging? Ah, I see. What clinging causes me to suffer? Well, the conception. This is what we're going to get to. Good question. No, it's a good question, really. The question of why physical pain has anything to do with suffering. You know, you hit your head against the wall. What does clinging have to do with that? No, that's suffering. You stub your toe. You know, there's no clinging involved, right? You're suffering. Yes, the answer, of course, is that there's two answers, and I talked about this in the last sutta. The first answer is that it's only suffering because you cling to it, right? You can have you can have a lot of pain and not suffer. But that's only one answer. And the Buddha's getting deeper here. He's calling these things suffering intrinsically. So it doesn't have anything to do with the clinging in this form, in this way of looking at it, or this frame of reference. That intrinsically all of these things are dukkha. People don't like to hear this, and this is where the whole idea of not being able to find any pleasure comes up. One thing you can say is that this was given to some pretty hardcore meditators, so they weren't the reason why this poses a problem and why people like to avoid this kind of interpretation of the Buddha's teaching is because we have clinging to pleasure. When you hear this, it's not pleasant. It's not what we want to hear. We want to hear the Buddha say, hey, do this and it will be pleasant. Do that and oh boy, you'll be set for life. You'll be happy. You'll get all this pleasure, right? So it's actually not the fault of reality. And part of the problem and part of the solution is to stop thinking about it. Because the only reason it's causing us suffering is because we start to think about it. Well, that doesn't that mean this and this? But that's why the important thing here is to look at experience. Because two things happen. One, you verify it. You verify that there's nothing pleasant. And two, you become so peaceful and happy as a result. You become so free as a result. So the whole question of finding some pleasure or so on disappears. You realize it was totally based on wrong thinking, a wrong understanding. The idea that it's the same about Nibbana. People say, Nibbana, that must be terrible. No coming back. It's a question that we got on the on Sunday, no, that I made a video about. Wouldn't it be better to suffer and live on? But it's all, you know, that's, we ask these questions because this is how we live in concepts. We don't live in ultimate reality, so we can't fathom what is actually the truth. And the answer to it is to stop thinking about it, stop philosophizing, stop worrying about it, and look for yourself. Start looking at what is really there. And judge for yourself. But to judge without doing that is improper. So the Buddha gave us a technique to look in a way that we have never been able to look, and to access a level of experience, level of reality that we didn't have access to before. That's what we're trying to do here. When you access that level of reality, in terms of understanding experiences moment to moment, then these questions just disappear. They you realize they were just a part of our delusion, misunderstanding. The thought that this kind of theory could bring about suffering, that the idea that every experience is intrinsically dukkha, that this could bring you some kind of suffering. It brings you suffering because you cling to it. That's the answer. So people don't like this because, well, they want to cling, and because we think that clinging is bringing us happiness. But then we always wonder why we suffer so much. If you substitute happiness for pleasure, is happiness what you get if you let go of everything? Yeah, you do get happiness, but that's just really a figure of speech. This is why the Buddha always talked about freedom from suffering, right? Escape from suffering. Because it's a lot easier and a lot more true. It's a lot less misleading. Because what do you mean by happiness? If you mean a happy feeling, then no, it's not pleasant, it's not true happiness. It's dukkha. Dukkha means it can't satisfy you. It's something that when you cling to it, you're going to hurt yourself. It's useless. It's unbeneficial. It has no purpose. Very difficult concepts to appreciate, but very easy once you start meditating. Because when you meditate, none of these thoughts come up, and you just experience. And you're like, oh, no, so much peace, so much happiness. Aho sukhang, you say, aho sukhang. And you don't think like that. You don't think, but I want this pleasure, I want that pleasure. Is physical pain part of dukkha? Well, getting back to this idea of hitting yourself against the wall, the truth of suffering is not the suffering feeling. I talked about this in the first sutta. There are four kinds of suffering. There's a suffering feeling, there's the suffering aspect of existence, right? Getting old, sick, and dying. There's the characteristic of suffering, and that's really what he's talking about here. And then there's the truth of suffering. The truth of suffering is basically that things are impermanent, that things don't last, that they're void, they are useless, they're garbage. Garbage might be a good way to describe them. They're not, maybe not garbage, they're just useless. They have no intrinsic benefit. And it's kind of, the I don't want to sound like we should be upset about this, but the point is to get rid of our clinging to it, because we cling to any number of things. And the practice is to understand the experiences to the point that we stop clinging. Well, the Buddha said, Natti Santi Parang Sukhang. There is no happiness without peace. So it depends how you understand happiness. Most people understand it as a pleasurable feeling, and therefore they They never understand, they never realize happiness because of the attachment to pleasure. Happiness is freedom from suffering. That's how I understand happiness. Yeah, that's how, that's the doctrinal answer, orthodox answer. But it makes perfect sense to me. I don't know how else you could understand happiness. It's also a rigorous answer or a disciplined answer, because any other answer is going to get you into trouble and is going to encourage you to cling. Nati santi parang sukhang, where is that? I believe it's the Dhammapada. Let's see if I can find it for you. Is that what you're referring to where I said nati santi parang sukhang? Nati santi. Must be in the Dhammapada. Yeah, Dhammapada. Right, it's in this verse. Dhammapada verse 202. Nati raga samo agi. There is no fire like lust. Nati dosa samo kali. What is kali? There is no misfortune like anger. Nati kanda sama dukha. There is no suffering like the five aggregates. Nati santi parang sukhang. This really sums up the Buddha's teaching in this sutta, or in regards to what we're talking about now. Because he points out that the khanda, the five aggregates that we're talking about, are dukkha. There is no dukkha like them. There's no way of understanding dukkha like that. And there is no happiness apart from peace. Verse 202. Okay, I don't think I got everybody's comments in here. Let's see, what? See arising, see disappearing. Yeah, John, you got it right. Yeah, no, I'm translating it myself. I'm doing on-the-fly translation. I use the Pali. I use the digital Pali reader, which is something that I actually created for the purpose. But verse 202, it should, no matter what... Well, there's a lot of weird translations out there. I recommend the Buddha-Rakita translation. Buddha-Rakita is... He's got a good translation. Okay. Buddha-Rakita. I believe his translation is also on Access to Insight, along with Tanasaro's translation. Some people like Tanasaro's translations. I'm not a fan of his translations. He's a great monk and he's got great knowledge of Pali, but I have a different choice of words. Okay, so hopefully this is... Remember, we're dealing with the core here. These guys are about to become arahants, for crying out loud. We're not dealing with some teaching on karma or rebirth or so on. This is getting to the core of reality. So no, it's not going to be easy for us to understand. If you read Mahasi Sayadaw's book on this sutta, Mahasi Sayadaw wrote a commentary on this, it's almost impossible to read. It's just so... It's not very interesting, really. It's not so pleasing to read. There's not so many stories. So it's something that is not... It's a teaching that is not going to bring about so much pleasure. Although hopefully I've been able to present it in a way that, at least for some of you, or at least for the side of all of us that is meditating, we should be able to appreciate and... It's a hard pill, bitter pill to swallow, I guess is what I'm saying. You have to wrestle with yourself over this one, because it flies in the face of what we think is true. It flies in the face of all of our life, right? Because for most of us, we're living in a lifestyle that assumes the benefit of certain pleasures, many pleasures. And so this shakes that up. So please remember, we're talking about people who have already discarded that, who have already left the home, gone off to live in the forest. So basically, okay, the important thing is what he's saying is what is impermanent is suffering, and that's really not trying to make a logical step there. It's really defining suffering. They're saying that can it really be called happiness if it arises and ceases in this way? So the manner of reflection, I would say, to answer this would be to think back about what is truly happiness, and you know, what do we understand about what experience of happiness have we had, and then to think of those things and to ask if they are equivalent. I mean, it wouldn't have been so intellectual, but they would have had to have done some processing of the words at least. What is the meaning of the word sukha? What is the meaning of the word anicca, or what are these things that are impermanent? So logically, you could say if it's impermanent, it's not really going to satisfy you. But I would say they would be looking at these things, and they would also be referring back to their experience of Nibbana. The other thing about this teaching is it's not really a beginner's teaching, because the Buddha gave it to people who are already sotapannas, who had already understood Nibbana. So it may point to why if we haven't experienced Nibbana, it's difficult to appreciate this, because you don't have a comparison. If someone asks you, well, what is sukha? You have to sit there and think about the sukha that you've ever experienced, the happiness that you've ever experienced. If you've never experienced Nibbana, then you don't have much to go on besides pleasure. So it's this is why we say, well, that doesn't seem like happiness to me. Of course, I mean, in that regard, perhaps you've never it's because you've never experienced Nibbana, never experienced something that is truly, truly happiness. And so your only frame of reference is other impermanent pleasures. This is why people say, well, you know, that's life. That's basically meaning that's all that you've got. What else are you going to get? And it's true, if you don't attain Nibbana, what else are you going to get? But they had realized Nibbana, and I think this is a big part of how they were able to answer these questions. So they could say, no, those aren't happiness, because those aren't the happiness that we've come to. Our happiness, our peace, is unrelated to those things. It's by discarding those things, discarding this impermanent flux, or these impermanent phenomena. And he says, okay. So that being said, because here's where they fail. They realize this, but the next sentence is where what he's trying to teach them, because they've got to come to become arahant. So he's got to get rid of the conceit inside of them. So he said, in that case, is it proper for you to sit here and say and complain about them? Oh, I have this pain and that pain, and to feel bad about this and to feel good about that. And to say, this is etang mama, this is mine. So clinging with tanha, with craving. Eso hamasmi, this I am, or I am this. Clinging with conceit, I am good, I am bad, I am high, I am low, I am something or other. Eso me ata, this is myself. Clinging with views, the view that, what is this? This is self. Is it proper? Is it proper to see it as, see about that thing, or to claim about that thing? Is it fit to be regarded thus? And they say, no hetang bante, no indeed not. No, I'm not highlighting. If you go to my note, you'll see where it says etang mama. There, I can highlight it. This is what I'm talking about, this here. Don't know if you see my cursor. Etang mama eso hamasmi eso meyata. And then in my note, I talk about these three, what these three are. Etang mama, this is mine, that's tanha or craving. Eso hamasmi, this I am, that's conceit. And eso me ata, this is myself, it's ditti or views. Ditti mana tanha, these are the three, I forget what they're called now. One teacher, he called them the three jnana gatika dhamma. And I could never find out where he got this from. It looks like it's some commentarial term, jnana gatika dhamma. They're dhammas that are, that pass as wisdom, or pretend to be wisdom. So, in this teacher, he would always say that if you don't use this mantra that we use, and if you just look and you watch things, you will think that you're meditating. You just sit there and you watch the breath, or you watch things coming and going, and you feel kind of, you know, equanimous about it. You will think that you're enlightened, and people will think that they're enlightened because of the experience that they have. But what they are still unable to uproot are these three things: views, conceits, and cravings. The idea that this is self, the idea, or the conceit, the idea of it being as good or bad, and tanha, the liking or disliking of it. So this is rupa. Then he goes on with vedana, with feelings. Are feelings permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? And then we come to this word determinations, which again should actually be formations. But determinations kind of gets you an idea of the sorts of things that it means. As determinations is a good example of what it means. But it means many different things. It means our thoughts about things. Once we experience things, let's go through these. First of all, we have the feeling. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? It's hard for us to say that feelings are permanent, right? Even intellectually, we can appreciate this. Pain doesn't last forever. And here's an interesting one. Here's where we sort of answer this question. Because the Buddha is saying that it's not because you hit your head against the wall that you're suffering. Or that's not what we're referring to here. What we mean by saying that feelings are dukkha means the fact that you can't be satisfied in regards to feelings. Even if you get rid of that pain, you're still not going to be satisfied. And the only reason that pain is hurting you is because you're clinging to it. But again, more on an experiential level, it just means the uselessness or the not making any diversification or proliferation of thought based on the experience. That's really how the experience of these things comes about. When you experience the pain as just pain, right, the mind lets go, the mind doesn't cling. So the meaning of why these things are dukkha, dukkha just means that there's no satisfaction to be had from them. There's nothing good you could do with these things. It's like you have a rock, and there was this. A rock is you know, without much use. You can use it for different things, but as an example, there's not a lot of. It's not an iPad, for example, right? But is this idea of getting of having something, the idea of it being something that is, you look at it and you say, well, that's kind of useless. That's really what is meant by dukkha here, because intrinsically these things have no, there's nothing you can do with it. Yeah, I've seen those pictures of the iRock. It actually compares quite well with the iPad, which is also dukkha and also useless. So if feeling is not to be satisfied, a good way to translate dukkha is not to be satisfied, not to be appeased, not to be controlled, not to be made pleasant. Right? Your feelings can never be the way you want them to be. I mean, what I mean by that is they can never be made to come to a state where they never disappoint you. As long as you cling to the smallest bit of feeling, you'll always have at least the smallest bit of suffering, because they're impermanent. Why are they suffering? Because they're impermanent. So you think, oh, okay, here's a good pain, good happy feeling. Guess what? It's not permanent. Kind of an interesting, another interesting thing about heaven, the idea that you could be in a permanent heaven. Suppose you could be eternally in a place called heaven. I mean, really, we are in such a state already. Now, we don't have to go to heaven. We still see, hear, smell, taste, feel, and think right here. Heaven might have increased happy feelings, but unless we become total zombies in heaven, we're still going to have these same thoughts, and we still have the potential to be disappointed. Right? I don't know. I mean, it's all theoretical. You can, because heaven is all in our minds anyway, you can always come up with an answer and say, oh, no, in heaven you never think bad thoughts, or in heaven you're never disappointed. Right? But it seems to me that at the very least it requires all of those people who are going to heaven to change radically, right? Because if you get all theists or all people who believe in heaven going up to heaven, man, it'd be a terrible place full of these people who still are full of defilements and corruption. And you want to be in a, all those people are still human. So unless when people go to heaven they're somehow cleansed of all their sins and perfect human beings playing harps and stuff, then it really is meaningless. I mean, the point is that as long as there is clinging, there will still be suffering. Okay, sitting in meditation, noting pain, seeing anicca, the persistence of pain arising again and again challenges conviction. Is there something important in staying with the pain? Yes, and you're seeing it. The arising, the challenge of your conviction, that's what we want to see. We want to see what's challenging your conviction, what's going on there, what you're clinging to. Because in that experience, there is disliking of the pain, for sure. There is doubt, right? And doubt is this kind of vacillation that stops you from seeing things as they are. And it obfuscates reality. I think that's the right term. It makes it blurry. Yes, that is important. We're not really interested in the pain, actually. We're interested in your reactions to it. Obfuscates. I knew how to spell it, I just couldn't say it. Obfuscate. I don't think I've ever said that word before. But it blurs, it obfuscates the reality of it. You know, doubt is a big one. So we want to see this doubt, and we want to look at it, and we want to root it out. Doubt is bad, directly bad, and we want to attack that because it's stopping us from seeing things as they are. We're not trying to brainwash people and say yes, but we're going to look at the pain for as long as it's there. We're going to experience it as pain, and doubt stops that. Doubt will make you have all sorts of views and ideas about it. So, I mean, that's a classic answer to meditation. People say, well, why am I doing this? It's just making me X, Y, or Z, right? And the classic answer is, that's why we're doing it, because we want you to see X, Y, and Z. We want you to see all these negative emotions. We want you to root them out. We want you to understand exactly where your suffering comes from. It doesn't come from the pain. Okay, so there's feelings. Perceptions. Perceptions are, that includes memories. So, I mean, there's lots of ways you can approach these. Yeah, this will all be, by Claudia, this will all be on, hopefully on the website. Hopefully people are, this is being recorded. So you'll be able to listen later if you like. Pick it up where you left off. If anyone has somewhere to go, you can find it later on our webs, on my weblog or my Facebook page or whatever. Great. Thanks, Linda. So with perceptions, we're also dealing with memories. And on a basic level, we can understand how memories are not true happiness, or are not going to satisfy us, because we remember all sorts of bad things. And as we talked about in last week's, as the Buddha said, can you say of your memories, they're going to be like this, not going to be like that? Can you say of any of these things? But okay, now he's getting a little bit deeper, right? And so we think of our memories or our perceptions of things. Sometimes we'll cling to this, our recognition of someone. Our recognition, memories is, I guess, the easiest way to understand it. When you remember something, we often think of how wonderful it is to have these memories, no? But they can't really satisfy us because they disappear. Oh, how wonderful it was then, and then it's gone, right? The memory of it. When it's gone, you're left wanting. You're left unsatisfied anyway. I mean, the most important part of it is that it didn't really help you. It didn't really help your mind. And that experience of pleasure of a past memory wasn't really uplifting. Well, worse than that, it's a bad thing, because the liking of it is actually sullying your mind. And if you practice meditation, you can see this. You can see how it changes your mind and makes you less clear in the mind, and like the Buddha said, more like this green sappy wood that is not, you can't burn it. It doesn't burn because it smokes. Smokes rather than burns. Smoke just clouds, and it can't produce fire to bring light. This is how the mind becomes. And yes, people also cling to memories of suffering. This is really, on an experiential level, it means our recognition of things, our ability to recognize things. So we recognize some things as things that bring us pleasure, right? Because recognition is going to lead to the next one, our determinations, as he says, our formations. First we're going to recognize it, And when we recognize a good thing, it's only because we recognize it as a good thing that it brings us pleasure. We recognize our, right, people who have amnesia, for example. It seems horrible, the idea of having amnesia. Stephen was telling me about this this guy who had amnesia, and he woke up every day and couldn't remember who he was. Couldn't remember his wife, and every day he had to ask, "Who are you?" kind of thing. So this is horrific for us to not remember. Could you imagine not remembering the people you love? Not remembering all the good times you've had? If all of that was wiped from your memory, how horrible that would be, right? So we think of these things as good, our ability to recognize things. Because why? Once we recognize them, we feel happy. Oh, here comes my best friend, here comes my relative, and so on. Here comes ice cream, whatever. Oh, this song again. Oh, this song reminds me of this. We feel pleasure as a result. The pleasure arises. But guess what? When someone says something you don't like, it makes you angry. When you see someone you don't like, you get upset or afraid. There was a big spider in Nick's room. Nicholas just came. It's kind of cute, actually. We showed him to his room. They came here, and I said, "Okay, you got a choice. One of you can have this leaky, termite-infested, snake-infested cave, and the other one of you can have this small, cramped room that is next to them." I'd actually tried to make this room sound a little better, because I think it's actually not as good. I like the caves better myself, so I didn't want whoever got the room to feel bad. And right away Matt says, Nick, I'll give you the room, you can have the room, I'll take the cave. So it was easily taken care of, and Nick got the room, and Matt got the cave. So Nick's in this room, and we opened the room up, and there on the ceiling was the big spider. It must have been like 2 inches in diameter, maybe more than 2 inches. But like big thick legs, and you know, it had an egg sack it was carrying around. I said, "Oh look, it's a mother. It's got babies." And I said, "Yeah, you'll just have to get that out. You probably should get it out, because I don't know. I have the idea that they can. I've heard people say that they do bite. They won't kill you or hurt you really, but might cause a red swelling or something. I don't know, even know if that's true. Everyone here says they're not poisonous. They don't bite, but they look pretty nasty." And I said, "Oh, you better get it out anyway." And I left, and about 5 minutes later, he comes to my room and says, "Bante, what do we do? What can I do about this spider or something? Like, or do you have a stepladder so I can get the spider?" And I said, "Yeah, well, just get a chair and go for it." And I said, "I mean, you're not afraid of it, are you?" And he said, "Well..." And so I had to get the spider out for him. Point being, and how it relates to what we're talking about, this idea of seeing things, right? How scary it can become. Because that's a big one. People come here and they can be so afraid of spiders. Yeah, in fact, and we had our first meditator here was this Romanian woman, and she was a woman alone in one of the caves. And I was staying in the other cave, so she wasn't really alone, but she had so much fear. And it wasn't irrational either. I mean, she had to go to the bathroom at night, so walking from her kuti to the bathroom, it was a scary thing at night. I imagine Jen's going to have a similar experience of fear. It can be quite scary to be alone in the jungle at night, because, you know, we're not... There are people can come and go. We don't know who's coming and going. Theoretically, I think the villagers are more afraid of the jungle than we are, so I'm not really that worried, but you never know. But these kind of conceptions bring about a lot of suffering. Recognizing unpleasant things. Hmm. fear certainly proliferates. I told this Romanian woman a funny story when I was young. I was alone at home. This is a very good example of how sanya, how perception leads to suffering. I was home alone in this big house. My parents lived in the forest, so we had this big house that my parents built. My father built with some other workers. And I don't remember, everyone had gone away. It was rare, but I was alone in the house. And in Canada we get some pretty strong weather, and so there was this wind gusting, and it was a dark and stormy night, as they say. And the whole house was made of wood, so the steps upstairs were made of wood, and I was in the upstairs in one of the rooms. And suddenly on the steps I heard this sound of stomping, this huge boom, 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 just huge noise of someone coming up the steps, just out of nowhere. And it I've never been so scared in my life. Maybe I have, but I can't remember any time that I was more afraid. And it continued on, boom, boom, boom. And it was like a ghost. This is obviously the thought that went through, the ghost walking up and down the stairs, stomping up or something, not a human being, making this huge noise. And, oh, it was horrible, lying in bed hearing this noise and giving rise to the perception that this was someone walking up and down the stairs. Can you fathom, what could it possibly have been? What else could it have been, unless someone was playing a terrible joke on me, which is a good guess. Turns out, above the stairs there were these big weather shutters, because there were big windows. My father had built these huge windows over the stairs, but then he realized that, you know, that's a big heat drain. So he had these huge shutters that were insulated to close it. And there was a window above them that was open. And so the wind was coming in, banging the shutters against the window over the steps. And it sounded exactly like someone stomping on the steps. Boom, boom, boom. Flapping back and forth. That's one story. This is how much suffering and fear, for example. It's talking about this idea of fear. And another story, when I was in Thailand, and we always laugh about this one. You know, in a foreign country, and I was kind of living in this village area in my uncle's house, northern Thailand. And in the middle of the night, suddenly I start to hear this noise, this voice say, Noah, Noah. My birth name is Noah, for those of you who don't know. So I heard this voice quite clearly. Noah, Noah, Noah. And again, it was. I mean, that would freak anyone out if you had this voice calling your name repeatedly over and over again. Any guesses as to what it was? Again, it wasn't someone playing a trick on me. There are birds in northern Thailand that say, Noah, Noah, I kid you not. We call them the Noah birds now. These are some stories of how sanya can really torture you. Especially in this case, sanya vipalasa, the misunderstandings. Misunderstandings are terrible, you know? I'm sure everyone's been in this situation where you say something and someone mishears you. Someone hears you wrong. Here's another story that I had. I was I was in Doi Suthep in northern Thailand, and this man from Germany came to practice with us, and he asked me, why did you become a monk? And I said, well, I became a monk to become an arahant. And he said, oh, really? Wow. And he went away. And he came back a couple of months later, and he asked me, so when did you become an arahant? And I said, what? And I said, when did I ever give you the idea that I was an arahant? When did I ever say? And he said, well, you told me last time that you were an arahant, that's why you were ordained. You were ordained because you were an arahant. And I said, that's not what I said at all. I ordained for the purpose. And he said, oh, well. And he said, I've been going around telling people that there's this arahant living up on Doi Suthep. He went down to Chiang Mai and he said, you should go practice on Doi Suthep. There's an arahant living up there. This guy says he's an arahant. And I said, oh, no. He'd been going around telling people that I was claiming to be an arahant. But that happens a lot, and it's frightful. It's this part of the universe that is misunderstandings based on misconceptions. It's very difficult to know who is an arahant. I think you know for yourself, and that's about the best you can do. Maybe the answer, it takes one to know one, is the best answer. Where are we? So yes, this is perceptions. Number four is sankhara, or formations. Our mental formations about an object. This is our likes and dislikes. Traditional ways to identify arahants. Well, no greed, no anger, no delusion. You spend a lot of time with them. Like I spend a year with my teacher, but like 5 hours a day sitting by his side and seeing him at his worst in regards to the amount of stress he had to put up with, seeing him at the time when he had to deal with the most stress. So at the time when he would have been most likely to exhibit greed, anger, or delusion. And I never experienced one instance where it made me think that he was giving rise to any of them. Or do you know someone who is known to at least stream enter? I don't know about these questions. I mean, I understand where they're coming from, but it's not the kind of question that I want to answer. I mean, this is like putting it's kind of putting me on the spot. I mean, not, I don't mean like that. I mean, it's committing myself to that kind of answer is it gives rise to conceiving, you know? Then you'll conceive of that person as being a sotapanna. And I understand the idea that, yeah, you want to find a teacher or you want to find someone who you can trust. But really you should trust the Dhamma. And you should trust people who speak the Dhamma. And, you know, consider that you're... No, it's not rude. I don't mind the questions. I get them a lot. And in fact, Sri Lankans are incredible. People come up to me and say, you know, they've never met me and they say, so, have you... What did they say? Some of them would even like, so are you an arahant or something like that? I mean, I can't remember exactly, but it was something like that. And at any rate, it was like, so have you realized the truth or something? Or have you come to see freedom from suffering? And, you know, it's not really appropriate. The questions are not really appropriate. You're better off to See, because it's cheating, kind of. You know, I spend a year with my teacher. I still don't know if he's an arahant or not. But you know, I have great that year gave me a great understanding of who he is, and a profound appreciation of who he is, and that's much more important. Spend time with people, and when you see that they are giving rise to greed, anger, and delusion, then you can temper your appreciation of them accordingly. It's that's much better way of approaching the whole question. Look for, because your idea of what a sotapanna is not really, unless you are a sotapanna already, it will not make much significance. It'll just make you give you faith in that person, and then maybe you'll be doubting, well, is he really, does he know what he's talking about when he says this person's a sotapanna, that person's a sotapanna? The correct way, as I said, is to spend time with someone, and then you'll understand. The other thing is not to judge people too harshly, because the one thing you learn over time is that people who meditate even a long time still have defilements. Until they become an arahant, they still have they still get angry, they still get upset, they still cling to things. I mean, one of my first meditation teachers, I found out later, he plays tennis. Maybe that doesn't mean a lot to you guys, but in a Buddhist setting, it's kind of absurd to think of a... I think he stopped now, but he said to me, I think I have to stop playing tennis, because it kind of gets in the way. It's hard to be mindful when you're playing tennis, right? You're enjoying it and you're not mindful. You're getting caught up in it. And I thought, wow, he's still playing tennis. But to judge him for that, it makes me think, well, he's probably not an arahant. But you have to give credit where credit's due. You know, if someone has some purity of mind, because even a sotapanna can get angry and upset at times, for sure. They will have a lot of suffering. They can suffer a lot, potentially, because they still have a lot of emotions that they are still working out. But they will have clarity of mind, and they'll be able to teach. And the best way we can support more people to become sotapanna, more people to become enlightened beings, is to work in this way, to appreciate each other and to cultivate the good. And rather than judging and saying, oh, that teacher is bad and so on, which I guess I'm guilty of as well sometimes. But I think my outlook is to try to appreciate people. And what I've been critical of other teachers sometimes of not being that way. You know, when you say your way is the only way, or when people criticize our technique and say, oh, that technique is no good, or so on. Because, you know, that's along these lines of depreciating goodness, or pointing more to the faults. The test is time. The Buddha said, spend a long time with someone, then you can test whether they have a lot of defilements. Is it not true if you admit to being an arahant that you probably are not one? That, yes, I've heard that many times by experienced, by teachers, and the Mahasi Sayadaw says it. It makes sense to me. I can't see why an arahant would... Not why, I can't see an arahant ever doing that. It's just very much a part of their nature to not. That would be my explanation. Yeah, we need a machine. We need a defilement machine. And plug it in like a lie detector test. Or those EKGs or something. Well, an EKG could probably tell you a lot, because it could point to where the anger, where anger affects the brain and so on. EKG, I don't know, whatever these brain machines they have are. Apparently they have a brain machine now that can tell what you're seeing. It can create a picture of what you're seeing based on your brain patterns. Okay, anyway, a little bit off track here, but still dealing with the general subject. So, in regards to our thoughts, in regards to our formations, them being impermanent, you know, we don't always like things, right? We are and in fact, this is where the scary, this is where meditators, when you begin to meditate, you really become freaked out by your emotions. You become shocked, and it really wakes you up to see the danger in your thanks, John. The importance, what we are working on here is the sutta, is the importance of seeing anicca in meditation. It's actually the importance of seeing anatta, which comes from anicca. But anatta is the important part. It's the conclusion that comes, because you don't cling to something as being self, as being me or mine. Whereas we cling to, otherwise we cling to experience. We cling to it as good and bad, and as something that I am experiencing or so on. But yeah, at this point, the key to that is to see impermanence. And then, as a result of that, to see that it's not going to satisfy. And it's interesting, because he's actually implying that it doesn't matter whether it is or isn't self. You know, he's basically saying, I don't care whether it is or isn't self. Or no, I don't ask the question of whether it is or isn't self. But is it good for you? Is it proper for you to say that? No, first of all, is it logical? Second, is it going to benefit you to take it as a possession? Right? If you have a pile of rotten feces or so on, or a bunch of rotten, if you have a rotten carcass, a dog carcass or something, would it be fit to say, that's mine? You know, would it be good to carry it around with you? So again, I want to drive home the fact that we're not looking at this philosophically in terms of, is there a self, isn't there a self? We're looking at this in terms of experience. So all of these theories and philosophies should just go out the window, and we should look at our experience and say, this thing, this experience that I have, permanent or impermanent? It's impermanent. When you see that, you'll see that it's actually useless, and you won't cling to it. You won't find any reason or any foothold, you know, whereby it could be clung to. There won't be any idea based on it. So our thoughts about things are impermanent as well. This is a good example here is of our likes and dislikes. Right? People say, I like this, I like that. And so they get the idea of self, they get the view of self. Right? First of all comes the conception that it is I that is liking. Then there comes the thought that this is I. And then there comes then after a while there becomes the view. Yeah, I'm the sort of person, or I don't like onions, or I don't like garlic, or I like abstract art, or I like country music, or so on. And this gives rise to atta. This is really, on a broad sense, what he's talking about here. When you begin to meditate, you see that that's not how it is at all. These thoughts, these mental formations, they arise quite chaotically, actually. Chaotic? No. They're a mess. And it's like we've been throwing garbage into our closet for years and years and years. Now we open it up and oh boy, we got a mess to deal with inside. All messed up, tangled up chaos in our minds. We see, it was quite simplistic of me to say that I like this and I like that, because actually these likes and dislikes, first of all, that they're uncontrollable. Likes, for example, dislikes as well. We think I like this, I like that, and that's just a habit that we've developed. When I was in university, this is part of my path and part of the path that led me to become a monk was this realization that my desires had no rhyme or reason to them. So I would have this crush on a girl, and I would, you know, be, you know, trying to get into a relationship with her, and then that didn't work out, and suddenly I'd find another one and another one, and then I'd be like interested in two or three different people or so on, and I'd have these desires for this, and it in the end I was just, no, this is way before I even started meditating, but it just hit me that this is how the mind works. This is what this love thing is. It's a fire. And so when I heard the Buddha, you know, it was just exactly what the truth is. When the Buddha said, Natti raga samo agi, there's no fire like lust. It's so true, because it knows no bounds. Fire can be contained, right? Fire will spread from trees to grass to... it spreads from one thing to another. Whatever the fuel is, it will go from one to another. But you can contain it. Rocks will not generally burn. Water will not burn. So there are things that it won't jump to. But craving will jump to anything. And you can only see this when you limit your perception, when you take yourself out of your environment. Because when you're in your environment, you think, I like this, I like that. When you take yourself out of that, you'll find yourself liking and disliking the stupidest things. Right? So sometimes when people come to meditate, the food is so delicious and they're just craving it at night. Right? And sometimes just the smallest things. When you have when you're sitting in your room in meditation and suddenly the crickets start bothering you, or the sound of the squirrels, right? Things that normally would never have bothered you. Uh-oh. So it is implied that all cognitive emotional processes occur due to uncontrollable circumstances, either through deterministic, randomized, ionic activities, or both. No, I think the point of the ionic reference is that quantum physics takes effect at the ionic level. And the theory of quantum physics puts the conscious, one theory of quantum physics, the orthodox theory, puts consciousness at the center. Process one, which is the conscious intervention. And when there is conscious intervention, the decision that I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that, that's where reality occurs. So it's not saying that there is determinism. The Buddha is not giving a theory of determinism. This is why I said it last week. We have to throw out our framework. How we're approaching this teaching, how we're approaching reality, we have to throw it out. Stop thinking in terms of deterministic, free will, self exists, self doesn't exist, this exists, that exists, doesn't. We're thinking practically here. And we're doing so not only because it's useful to think practically, but also because that's the truth. The truth about reality is that there's nothing besides experience. That experience is the framework. So the idea of a deterministic universe and so on, and a free will and so on, it fits into the wrong framework. The framework is that our decisions affect, or the decisions made, however you want to understand it, decision-making will affect the future, basically. Now, the idea of what those decisions are, you see that the Buddha is not approaching that. But He's saying that to call them a self, to say that this is me and this is mine, is not proper. Basically here, the emotions that we give rise to, the likes and the dislikes. Many other things as well, but that's probably the most important, is our likes and dislikes. So what it means to say is that, you see, this is the problem. You can't ask, if they are not self, then what are they composed of? They are what they are. That's the point. They are not something more than that. So the Buddha is saying, adding on the words etang mama, this is mine, esoham asami, this I am, or eso me ata, this is myself, is improper. That's what he's saying. He's not being philosophical. He's not being, he's not putting down a theory of a reality. He's pointing out the way out of suffering. He's pointing out that this way leads to suffering. It's practical, and it's very much how things are in reality. So these feelings are not self. These feelings are not. They're just feelings. Our thoughts, our likings and our dislikings, our emotions. These are just emotions. They come and they go. And the idea that I am emotional in this way or that way, is improper. Improper thought. It's just delusion. Correct is to see the thoughts as they are. When you like something, to see it as liking. When you dislike something, to see it as disliking. That's correct. Let's understand it that way. I hope that's getting closer to what I'm trying to say. Or hopefully closer to what the Buddha is trying to say. Okay, number 5 is consciousness, permanent or impermanent. Consciousness is, I guess, the big one, because we think of ourselves as being conscious all the time. Right? That's where we really think self is. So, for the people who still have the idea of self, they will hopefully have kind of, agree with me up to this point. But here they've got me. Here they say, aha. Now I see. Now we've got a problem. Because he's not going to be able to tell us that consciousness is not self. They'll say, I was with you until that one, but now I have to put my foot down. Consciousness is self. Consciousness is the soul. Now I know where the soul is. Right. This is what I was thinking of when I thought of myself. Consciousness. So how are we going to get out of this one? Well, again, we're going to meditate. Because if we don't meditate, we'll never see it. It's too fast. But when you meditate, suppose you focus on the rising and the falling of the stomach, you'll see the consciousness arises and ceases. There's the consciousness of the stomach that arises and then it ceases. And then suddenly another consciousness will arise, totally unrelated. Suddenly you'll start thinking about something, or suddenly you'll start hearing something or seeing something, and you'll get off onto a totally different tangent. And you'll begin to see how this works in a very chaotic manner. You'll see that there's really a break between one consciousness and the next. And you'll see that the idea that consciousness is permanent is just an illusion, because it's too fast. Like, if you ever had those sparklers, you know, we have these sparklers that you light and they make sparks. I think it's magnesium or something. And we used to wave them in the air, and you can make a circle, you can draw letters in the air with them, no? And it looks like it's constant. Well, that's maybe a silly example, but you see something there that's not there. And actually, it's really just arising and ceasing, but because it's moving so quickly, or a movie, for example. You know, in the old days they had these film, no, and it was just a series of pictures that would go so quick that it looked like it was moving. Or, you know, those, even better, those little books that they had before where you turn the pages really quickly and it looks like the character is dancing or something. Steven, you're too much a scientist. These questions are off track. Are they? Maybe this is an okay one. Let's see. So it's consciousness that realizes the fleeting nature of itself. Yeah, I guess technically speaking, yes. Technically speaking, that's correct. Because there will be a conscious, and but it's not itself. No, actually, you're that's not correct. Can't be. Because a consciousness cannot realize the fleeting nature of itself. It realizes the fleeting nature of other consciousnesses. It gives rise to, or there arises, the consciousness that consciousness is, or all consciousnesses are momentary. Yeah. Again, it has to be practical, because by practical is meant it has to be real. It has to be what it is. So consciousness is impermanent. Because it's impermanent, it can't satisfy. Why can't it satisfy? I mean, there are many reasons. The classic answer is because you can't. But that's the first part. Right? When he said that it's you can't say that you're only going to experience this, only going to experience that. But the idea that here we're talking more about the idea that a consciousness can satisfy, no? Well, the idea, this is really the point, that any experience, an experience of a pleasant feeling, for example, the reason why it's impermanent is because consciousness is impermanent. The consciousness of a pleasant feeling, because the experience of pleasure in the body, for example, can be continuous, right? Arising continuously. The chemicals are fire, they're doing their thing constantly. But the experience of it is inconstant. Our experience of even pleasant feelings is just momentary. And that's why it can't satisfy. What could you do to make the consciousness last? It's like trying to catch water in a sieve. You can't keep it. It comes and it goes and arises very quickly. So that experience of pleasure, this experience of pleasure, could not bring happiness. Yeah, intellectual understanding isn't comparable to a meditative experience, for sure. But you can see where the Buddha was really challenging and really getting to the core. I hope I'm giving a little bit of an understanding of how this was came across and how it was presented to try to challenge this and to get rid of all of this. So yogis and Brahmins were believing in a morally perfect, permanent, independent Atman. I don't know what IAW is. The Upanishads. And Buddha was using their own experience to show them that their experience was conditioned and not otherwise. These were not lay people. And of course, thank you. I was using their own experience to show them that their experience was conditioned and not otherwise. Yeah, I guess, I see you're trying to put it in context, which certainly it has a context in Buddhist India. I guess I'm kind of trying to take it out of the context because we're not in Buddhist India. But but yeah, sure, there is a context There's a context in the presentation for sure. I mean, the debate-like context, the debate-like format is very much in accordance with the Upanishad, or well, the nature of debate at the time, the nature of presentation, and the terminology. But no, I mean, I don't think he's so much. He's certainly not getting at their views at this point, because they've gotten rid of their views already. I would look for that kind of explanation in the first sutta. But you know, you don't even find it quite so much there. It looks more like the Buddha's avoiding this kind of philosophical or theoretical argument. He's, as I said, he's just talking to some guys in the forest who are just guys at this point. At this point, they've given up their status as Brahmins or yogis or whatever they were before, because they've gotten rid of their views. They become sotapanna. So at this point, they're just guys in the forest, or not even guys, you know, they're just beings meditating. They have no views, no opinions. And so this is why he's able to just talk in terms of direct experience. And I think that's what he's doing. That's my interpretation of this sutta. This is a very cut and dry, no theory kind of down to earth, very down to earth sutta. So down to earth that it's very difficult for us to appreciate, because we're so much up in the sky. But yeah, he was using their own experience to, I like that part, using their own experience to show them their experience was conditioned. I would just cut to the chase and say, to show them that it wasn't theirs, it didn't belong to them, because that's what the sutta is all about. And that's really what the key is here, to help them to let go. But yeah, part of that is to see that it's conditioned and, well, impermanent, unsatisfying, and non-self, anicchang dukkhang anatta. And one thing I didn't mention is that he's really dealing with the core of vipassana here. Vipassana means to see impermanent, suffering, and non-self. He's dealing with the three characteristics. It's the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, but he's clearly dealing with all three characteristics, and that's what Mahasi Sayadaw makes clear in his book on this sutta. Very difficult to read book, but full of good stuff, full of good information and helpful explanations and examples as well. He gives lots of examples of ways we can understand these things. But he points out the fact that it's based on all three characteristics. So he's explaining how is it understood to be non-self based on impermanence, how it's based on suffering, because you can't stop the suffering from coming. You can't stop yourself from being conscious. I mean, here's an example. You can't stop yourself. That's dealing with the first part. Mahasi Sayadaw, the great discourse on non-self, not self or something. I think not self. Mahasi Sayadaw, not self, or Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. If you just look up Anatta Lakkhana Sutta with his name, it should come up with the title. It's on our website. I've got a whole bunch of his books that I just stole from the official site. I'm good at stealing Dhamma. Okay, we're going to stop there, because then we've got still one whole section to deal with. Wow, I thought we were going to finish it, but that's good. I realize it's perfect. We've just finished the second section, and we've got the third section left to go. So I hope I got through consciousness. Let's see what's left. Well, it's not proper to say that consciousness is self, is me or mine. Because even the consciousnesses are momentary. And so to think of them as being a self that is conscious. This is really core. And this cuts. This would be, at this point, they would be beginning to give up, and this may be the moment. At this point, maybe the moment where they. Maybe not. But this would be where they start to progress on the path to arahantship, when he starts talking about this, about consciousness, because it's really this the pinnacle. And then he's going to hit them in the next section with, well, he's hit them in this section, but in the next section he's going to bring about the profound consequences of this sort of realization, of this doctrine, the practical applications. What does it mean when you see this? Or, yes, because it's where he starts, Ewang Pasang. So, we are here. Thank you all for coming. It's been 2.5 hours, including all the internet interruptions. And again, this, if all goes well, this audio file will be available on my web blog audio feed and my Facebook page. Does Buddha provide an explanation as to why we have developed such a sharpened sense of ego? Why we have developed, well, it's habit. I talked about this last week, I think. I mean, we cling to things that arise based on ignorance. You know, why we cling to anything, why people gave rise to the idea of God? Because they put 2 and 2 together and get 5 or 6 or 7. We have a very difficult time putting 2 and 2 together and getting 4. Which is to be exact. We always add stuff on and add stuff in. So we experience things and there is proliferation. This is maybe what the Buddha talked about. The Buddha said, papancha. It's the proliferation. The fact that there's making more of something. And when we do that, then we start to put 2 and 2 together, we get 5 and 6, and part of that is our idea of self, the idea that we're controlling, right? I want to move my hand, and then my hand moves. Well, that means it's my hand, and that means it's I that am moving, and so on. But in fact, it really, that's the extras. You know, it was 2 and 2 is 4, which means when, you know, the wanting arises, and then the hand moves, or if you want to say, I want to move my hand, and then the hand moves. That's 2 and 2, 2 plus 2 equals 4. But when you say, okay, so that means the hand is mine, and so on, you're adding stuff. And so we add like this. And when you do this again and again and again, you experience things, and you make more of it. You try to find the answer, and your answer is more than the truth. Then you give rise to things like self and so on. That's really key. The key here is to give up all of that. Just give up the fluff and come back to, you know, you can say, I want to move my hand, and then my hand moves. Doesn't quite mean that I'm controlling my hand, but it's an explanation of reality. Once you come back to simple observation of how things occur, then there is no suffering. Okay, so have a good night, everyone. Good day or whatever. And we'll see you all tomorrow. Yeah, it's the tendency to embellish reality. So tomorrow we have our radio session, if the internet's still working. It seems to be pretty stable. And if our server is going to work, lots of complications, no?